I would like to extend a special welcome to guests this morning, Victoria Fitzmaurice and her daughter, Ollie. Ollie is the Kern Scholar at the Besant Hill School in the Ojai Valley. That scholarship is awarded for excellence in education and the potential for leadership and service. And Ollie certainly has this service component deep in her heart and in her life. Welcome. The philosopher Joseph Needleman, Jacob Needleman, in his book, A Sense of the Cosmos, explores the dynamic interplay of scientific knowing and spiritual perception. They exist, he suggests, in a reciprocal relationship, separate and yet interdependent. What may bring these ways of insight into harmony is what Needleman calls sustained awareness. And he begins with a story. For 10 consecutive days in December 1995, the NASA Hubble Space Telescope, orbiting far above the Earth's atmosphere, pointed its lens toward what seemed an uncluttered portion of the sky in the constellation Ursa Major. Astronomers narrowed the focus of the telescope to a tiny speck of black sky. "I was standing at a magazine rack," he says, "in a Borders bookstore, when I first saw the resulting photograph assembled from over 300 separate images. It was on the cover of the National Geographic. I was struck with wonder. A nearly microscopic point in an apparently empty patch of night sky was a window onto hundreds, thousands of stars. Many certainly greater than our own sun, and like our sun, pouring out unimaginable streams of life-creating energy onto who knows what planetary worlds, and onto who knows what living beings. I remember standing there for a moment with my eyes closed, sensing the mingling of impersonal joy and yearning that everyone sometimes experiences, looking up at a night sky strewn with millions of shining worlds." And then he goes on. "I put the magazine back and started to walk away, but after two or three steps, I stopped short. What had I actually seen? Something was not quite right. I turned around and went back to the magazine rack. My knees nearly gave way when I looked at the picture again. Could it really be? I opened the magazine again and this time very attentively read the explanation of the photograph. These were not stars at all. They were galaxies. Hundreds, thousands of galaxies never before known or seen inhabited that speck of empty sky. Each galaxy itself containing billions of suns. I suddenly became very quiet inside." The word cosmos, as Needleman points out, signifies that the universe itself is a living organism, vast in its extent and in the depth of its purposes and intelligence. And as Needleman says so beautifully, vast in its beauty and, above all, in its goodness. The aliveness of the universe has been affirmed by the world's great spiritual traditions in all cultures and times. This is our legacy. "And all who love science," Needleman continues, "must know this truth in their bones, because every day modern science offers evidence that the universe, reality itself, is alive beyond all imagining." What do these images, teachings, and discoveries mean for us Do we ponder these moments of wonder? The quieting of thought without effort, the heightened awareness. What is their significance for us now in these times when harmony among all our relations seems nearly impossible even to conceive? Jacob Needleman invites us to experiment. Step outside one starry night. Go to a place where the light pollution of man-made cities is lessened. Go to a place out there and in here, where our inventions of concepts and explanations no longer obscure the subtle sense of truth within ourselves. And look up at all those shining worlds. What do you know? What do you feel? It is the same question. Then he suggests, observe your inner state. Could you hate? Could you be overwhelmed by envy or resentment? Could you dishonor any man or any woman? Is it not true that your wish to know more and more about the great world around you is now joined to the deep yearning to serve one's neighbor and whatever it is that is for you and me, God? Is it not true that no man or woman has ever committed a crime in the state of wonder? Is it not true also that there is such a thing as sacred knowing? And can there be any real knowing worthy of the name that is not embedded in a sense of the sacred out there and in oneself? Does our world cry out for anything more fundamental than this sense of the cosmos? And is this not our legacy? Early this spring, the Ojai Valley, Crotona's home, enjoyed several days of light and steady rain. Always welcome in these coastal mountains of Southern California, the rain brought much needed nourishment. Nature responded, as she always does, with a wild greening of our meadows and mountain slopes. But something else caught the eye: the shifting play of mist and mountains. Never quite the same moment by moment. Clouds settled, drifted, and rose above the peaks, transparent to the warming sun. As we stopped to visit on the road one early morning, a friend remarked, "I don't want to eat or sleep or study or work. I only want to see these mountains." Marvelous. Some of you who know our Crotona residents might recognize that phrase, marvelous. He hesitated, then said quietly but with conviction, "It is the Father." Would we question his perception? Does his understanding not affirm for this man a world alive with intelligence, power, and creativity? It was for us a moment of shared understanding and an affirmation of what it is that sustains servants of the light. Moments of wonder are common among children who may recognize their importance. The young son of a rabbi was in the habit of spending his prayer time in the forest. Perhaps concerned for his safety, the boy's father reminded him that, after all, God is the same everywhere, to which the boy replied, "But I am not." Becoming aware of the subtle nature within oneself, especially that which seeks and responds to beauty and harmony, is the beginning of a meditative life, one in which inner and outer action are fully aligned. And it is not uncommon in children. The ageless wisdom reveals a cosmos alive through and through in many dimensions. Our planet is embedded in, permeated by, shaped and transformed within a vast array of forces. Several principles central to what has been termed the secret or sacred science are central to any inquiry into creative meditation. And these, of course, you will be familiar with. They are explored in detail in Madame Blavatsky's works, especially The Secret Doctrine and Isis Unveiled. The first is that an omnipresent reality, impersonal because it contains all and everything, is latent in every atom of the universe and is the universe itself. The universe is the periodical manifestation of this unknown absolute essence. It cannot be identified with a being of any kind that can be conceived by the human intellect. It is important to consider that these principles, which to us may seem so lofty and unreachable and perhaps even irrelevant to our work in daily life, these principles have been given to us by an adept brotherhood, among whom are those who have participated in generations of observations of the inner side of nature. They don't observe nature or ourselves from the outside, but from the inside by participating in its life, and especially in participating in a positive way in the moving of life forward, which is the real way of science. Parallel to these studies is our own human experience, and what is it that we have found? What is it that we feel and know? There is an essence within the soul, deep within the core of the human being, that has been described by our mystics as well as our adepts, sages and seers, as a light, uncreated, unconditioned, deathless, universal, untouched by space and time. It is not an abstract light, far removed from our own daily life, but it can be realized. It can be discovered. It is the hidden life, light, and love of Annie Besant's beautiful invocation. And it must be realized as a presence, a reality in daily life. The most beautiful thing about this discovery is that it is made at the same time as one realizes that there is one life in all, one life in all individuals, creatures, and in all things. This discovery is for the human being our highest purpose. It is the supreme goal of any incarnation. Discovering this fire, this light, this wisdom within the depths of our own being so that it can be shared, brought forth in other forms of life. The second principle then that we realize for ourselves, affirming the adept declarations, is that everything in the universe throughout all its kingdoms is conscious, endowed with a consciousness of its own kind and on its own plane of perception. Also, as we begin to participate in this greater life, we find that the universe is worked and guided from within outwards. As above, so below. As in heaven, so it is on earth. The whole cosmos is guided, controlled, and animated by what Madame Blavatsky has termed an almost endless series of hierarchies of sentient beings, each having a mission to perform, and each one an agent of karmic and cosmic law. We are among those creative hierarchies. We are one of them as a human being, as a human soul. And again, the whole order of nature is on a progressive march to a higher order of being. There is design in the action of the seemingly most blind forces in nature. Nothing happens to us which is not a part of this greater order. J.L. Walker, in The Quiet Place That Buddhas Love, notes that the purpose of meditation on nature in the Buddhist way is not to establish an emotional relationship with it, but instead to see uncontrived nature as it is, and to learn to recognize that nature in ourselves. The healing potential of nature depends on our finding this non-ordinary, transformative, vertical dimension. Otherwise, all we have is a horizontal translation of it, another way of looking at nature, instead of a powerful force for change in our lives as we live them in the world. The Native American poet Red Hawk suggests something of this absorption in a wider life. On our knees, drinking with cupped hands from our creek, is a kind of praying for my daughters and me. In time of drought, there is nothing holier than the water in the bowl of our hands, poured over upraised faces or sipped on bended knee, giving thanks. Religion is such a simple thing. Either it is cupping hands in deep gratitude and filling them with creek water and swallowing God whole, or it is nothing at all. Madame Blavatsky has defined meditation as the inexpressible longing of the inner man for the infinite. The sacred science affirms that meditation is essential to human progression and perfection. Perfection, maybe, is full participation in the wholeness of life, the awakening of all our latent human faculties. For each one of us, the progression and the perfecting are unique, and yet meditation is a universal practice, born of love and longing, which can bring us in closer alignment with the divine within ourselves and all beings. Then we may begin to fulfill our purpose as human beings in a world radiant with intelligence and hidden meaning. One of the things that I have appreciated about the Theosophical way of life and worldview is that it helps us to orient ourselves in a world that often appears chaotic. One view is that a human being is one who possesses a sevenfold nature, spanning all dimensions of this world, from physical to spiritual, mortal to immortal. We belong to all these spheres of activity. The human kingdom participates in the life of every other kingdom on earth, visible and invisible. We share their substance. We share their consciousness. They influence us, and we influence them, for good or ill. As the doctrine states, we are all progressing to a higher life together. At this stage, human beings are conscious mostly of personal relationships. The sense of separateness from each other and from other life forms is very strong. Identity, we know, revolves around a physical body and subtle, highly charged, emotional and thought fields. These fields are in constant activity, highly reactive to sensation and impulses from their environment. They are easily conditioned so that the life force tends to pool in habitual emotional and thought patterns, most self-serving, resulting in low energy and an obstruction to the innermost light. The Bhagavad Gita gives us a lovely image of this. Restless man's mind is so strongly shaken in the grip of the senses, gross and grown hard with stubborn desire. Truly, I think, the wind is no wilder. And yet, how beautifully the body, the emotions, and the mind fields serve us. A steady, patient effort is needed to understand and direct the living elemental forces of these subtle bodies. They help our ideas and plans come to life in the physical world when rightly ordered. And when purified of unhealthy desires, habits, and limiting ideas, they become increasingly responsive to the will, wisdom, and love of the spiritual self. And they help us to align ourselves with forces perhaps greater than ourselves, the world of the masters of wisdom, the hidden worlds of angels and archangels, their inspiration, their strength, their guiding wisdom. All this our bodies make possible. We must never diminish their worth. Mindfulness, being fully present for whatever comes our way, orders and refines these forces and opens the body, heart, and mind to creative relationship. Clara Codd notes, we must learn to realize that though we are not the body, it is a marvelous and delicate mechanism evolved through aeons of time for our use. We will then begin to live more consciously as a soul, realizing that the inner life, the life of motives, ideas, feelings, and aspirations, is far more potent for self-development and to affect others than anything we do in the physical world. We have experienced a little of how mindfulness engages the mind and heart to focus our attention. As aspects of mindfulness, sympathy, devotion, and aspiration are powerful forces. They help us to focus thought, to steady the mind on whatever is before us. Gradually, attention begins to shift easily inward, within and through appearances. Relationships deepen with subtle energies, refined emotion, ideas important to health and healing, ideals. Meditation is a state of consciousness where a subject is held lightly in mind and heart, with no attempt on our part to coerce or to control. Consciousness welcomes and reaches out in goodwill with the intention simply to inquire, to understand. The subject of meditation, as we know, may be an ideal, a virtue, a situation needing illumination, a sister or brother in need of help, a divine teacher, nature herself. In all cases, what inspires this inner dialogue is love. Evelyn Underhill, in her book Practical Mysticism, has a lovely way of speaking simply about these interior changes. The subject of your meditation, she says, begins as you surrender to its influence. It begins to exhibit unsuspecting meaning, beauty, and power. As you bring increased attention to bear on it, it grows perpetually in significance. It ceases to be thin and abstract. And she says that that attention that we're bringing to bear is the foundation of all our knowing and all the meaning we find in feeling. You learn, Underhill goes on, in this still, intent communion, something of its depth and breadth and height, much as we learn in our communion with a good friend, something of the inner life of that individual. As your meditation deepens, it will defend you from the perpetual assaults of the outer world. You will hear the busy hum of that world as a distant exterior melody. You have set a ring of silence between you and it. And behold, within that silence, you are free. Madame Blavatsky speaks also of what she calls a heart space of silence, in which we may find refuge when we are in need. But, she says, we may dwell in that silence only if we keep in our sight the work we are doing in the outer world. We must not, she says, lose sight of the battle. So this cushion of silence between ourselves and even our world of daily life is brought about by a certain kind of attention to relationships which we approach from the inside out, attending to what is beyond appearances. So in a measure, these are Underhill's words, you have found yourself. You have retreated behind all that flowing appearance, the busy, unstable consciousness with its moods and obsessions, its feverish alternations of interest and apathy, its conflicts and irrational impulses, which even the psychologists mistake for you. You have discovered in your inmost sanctuary a being not wholly practical, who refuses to be satisfied by your busy life of correspondences with the world of normal men and women, and a being which hungers for communion with a spiritual universe. This life, she says, so foreign to your surface consciousness, is yet familiar with it, and in some ways continuous with it. You recognize this inner life as the true self. It is the agent of all our contacts with what is real. Meditation is not complicated. On the contrary, it simplifies consciousness, awakening joy and curiosity and wonder in everyday happenings. Consider this simple offering by the theologian and mystic Thomas Merton. What a thing it is to sit absolutely alone in the forest at night, cherished by this wonderful, unintelligible speech, the most comforting speech in the world, the talk that rain makes by itself all over the ridges, and the talk of the water courses everywhere in the hollows. Nobody started it. Nobody is going to stop it. It will talk as long as it wants, this rain. As long as it talks, I'm going to listen. Can we be inwardly renewed by these contacts in daily life with things that others take for granted or even deem as unwelcome or irrelevant? Can we feel cherished and comforted at times by the sound of rain? Perhaps not if it's flooding through your basement. But perhaps there is some comfort to be taken even in these apparent catastrophes. The mystic is one who can find that joy in all things, even working to alleviate his or her own suffering and the suffering of others. Meditation is listening to the speech of the earth herself, the voices of mountains and meadows, trees, oceans and rivers, thunder and wind. Though the earth is suffering, many are listening and responding with compassion and insight. We know it. I've been so inspired by the stories that you have told of your work. Your images, your words on your posters have brought me to tears. I'm very humbled by the energy, enthusiasm, and the passion you have brought to the work you're doing. And also in the stories you have told about all of the other things that are going on in your busy lives. Families, jobs. Sickness, disability in your own life and in those of your loved ones, in your animal companions. Through all of this, you continue to work and to give. I have observed just around me in the life of the Ojai Valley a lot that gives me courage and inspiration. And these are just a few things. In all of this, we know that global need inspires all of us. But folk wisdom, local wisdom, must guide the actions. In our valley, the community-supported agriculture now brings fresh organic produce to restaurants, schools, and residents. A local initiative, Food for Thought, helps create public school gardens tended by students who also learn about healthy meals. Junk foods are being eliminated in schools and taken out of vending machines. Amazing. Farmers' markets encourage small farm agriculture, a seasonal and regional diet, and produce free of harmful toxins. Help nature and work on with her, directs the voice of the silence. And nature will regard thee as one of her creators and make obeisance. One of the most beautiful statements in the voice of the silence. The passage continues to unfold how nature will then open the treasures of her heart to those worthy of her secrets. Becoming worthy is the task before us. As we ponder the challenges in meditation of a clean and sustainable way of life, this pondering draws us into communion with practical challenges in the domain of insight and wisdom, which must be the source of all our creative endeavors. Madame Blavatsky is less poetic in her instructions. If you could foresee what I foresee, whole nations drifting insensibly into black magic, you would begin heart and soul to spread the teachings of universal brotherhood. It is the only safeguard. Purify the hearts of people. Universal brotherhood rests on the common soul. It is because there is one soul common to all men that brotherhood or even common understanding is possible. Bring men to rest on that and they will be safe. There is a divine power in each which is to rule his life and which no one can influence for evil. Let men bring their lives under its guidance and they have nothing to fear. There is perhaps nothing that mobilizes people today to work together as one body than responding to a common and immediate need. Emergencies and catastrophic events may bring an extraordinary sense of connection and self-sacrifice. Less dramatic is when a community is mobilized to consider its own future in a systematic way. Steve Bennett, our county supervisor, and his staff envisioned and organized a series of valley-wide discussions for residents to set priorities for the Ojai Valley. 100 of us volunteered to meet together 4 times over 1 to 2 years. We met for 3 hours each time. Grouped randomly in tables of 5 to 7 people, most of us were strangers, we were given questions and action items to consider. The discussions were extremely focused, as we were very time limited. But the hum of conversation was constant. Priorities emerged quickly, as each table signaled its consensus and action priorities. The results were computerized on site by student volunteers and projected on a huge overhead screen. We were meeting not in a fancy hotel, but in a school gymnasium, and at another site, a campsite meeting room. What impressed me the most was the ease with which we meshed into a single body in service to a wider cause. Our group of 100 identified common values with all the whole community in mind. Our commitment to the valley as a whole and our willingness to work intensely over time resulted in the development of a community emergency response team and the expansion of several green projects. The community response team is especially important. The training has been ongoing and many residents have been involved. All of Southern California, as you know, is a somewhat vulnerable area of the country. Earthquakes, floods, landslides, wildfire, we've got it all. The Ojai Valley is a relatively peaceful place in all of this wildness, but we are surrounded by national forest, and the dangers are there, and occasionally the earth trembles. And we all look at each other and hope it will not last for long. So having an emergency response team in place, not a few folks, not even a dozen folks, but residents in every community who are learning to be first responders is essential. And this actually came out of and is ongoing because of this valley-wide discussion. Now, were these 100 folks pure? We were not. Is this a purified consciousness working collectively? No. It's just folks who are service oriented. And we're on our way toward being able to let our own needs go for a while we consider the needs of our whole community. And we act in their name. We act in the name of the thousands who will depend upon the projects that we envision coming out of this intense work together. So, the need to identify core values and actions quickly, without debate, then achieve consensus on matters which affect thousands, requires focus, flexibility, respect for one's neighbors, trust, and acceptance of the outcome. A willingness to work, then, for projects that maybe have not been your priority. Such gatherings, carefully visioned and coordinated, not only prepare the mind and heart for meditation, they also challenge meditators to respond intelligently under pressure and in unfamiliar circumstances. What better training? Learning to work together in ways that purify and develop the inner life is essential to combat the dark energies of prejudice, superstition, and scapegoating. Enshri Ram advised that what we should aim at is to bring such help to people as will make a fundamental difference to their lives. And there must be the realization that we ourselves must have the necessary understanding before we can give real help to others. An important recent development is the introduction in our public and private schools of classes to help teachers and students develop self-understanding and relationship skills. Classes in mindfulness, emotional intelligence, conflict resolution, values clarification, and stress reduction engage even very young students at their own level of maturity. Some parents and teachers resist these programs, considering them to be irrelevant or a form of religious indoctrination. This is inevitable. Opposition fades when the result is a better learning environment for all. Rhoda Bernier has emphasized, the inner forces are far more powerful than anything at the outer level. It is the experience of everyone who has worked unselfishly and brought a certain purity within that obstacles melt away when necessary, openings are made when one proceeds in the right way. Meditation as a form of self-understanding and self-preparation is a vital part of theosophical work. When a person comes to the threshold of truth perception, Rhoda Bernier advises, everything in life changes, and we also have the power to influence change around ourselves. There are many things in life to see and to do. The most important of all is to realize the significance of life and perceive the true relation of the many existences with each other. One who sees significance cannot be destructive. It is the quality of our being and the spirit of understanding and selflessness which we bring to all we do that makes service theosophical. When that quality exists, a spiritual influence pervades the work and affects others, helping to bring about transformation. I think it was at lunchtime the other day that we had an Asian meal and had a chance to pick up a fortune cookie. Around me at the table, everyone got, your day will be wonderful. Mine was, He who has not tasted the bitter does not understand the sweet. The meditative mind and heart is awake and open to joy and sorrow, moments of wonder and moments of sorrow, moments of despair. But let us welcome with gratitude all that comes before us, that we may give as any besant without reserve. Asking nothing, hoping nothing for the separated self. Content to be in the light and in the dark, to be active or passive, to work or to wait, to speak or to be silent, to receive praise or reproach, to feel sorrow or joy. Our only wish then is to be instruments, instruments for the wisdom, love, and life of the Holy Ones. Then we can say truly that we are a theosophical order of service, and that within this wider life, each one of us is a servant of the light. I thank you.